Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. We're glad to have you with us. The U.S. Department of Labor estimates that between 3 and 4 million workers are displaced every year, losing their jobs through no fault of their own. Now, at the industry level, these displacements can have enormous impact. But according to our guest for this hour, sociologist Robert Hieronymus Wendt, very little research has been done on the human consequences. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we will talk about some of the work that he has done documenting the experiences of displaced workers and their families here in Illinois. And of course, questions and comments from people who are listening are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call if you're interested in joining the conversation, and we certainly welcome that. The only thing that we ask of callers is that they try to keep their comments and questions brief so we can keep moving along, but anybody who's interested in joining us should feel free. The number, again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest, Robert Hieronymus Wendt, is a professor of sociology. He is assistant professor of sociology at Western Illinois University, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. Well, Professor Hieronymus Wendt, hello.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm fine.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. I certainly was struck by the kind of numbers that we're talking about here, and that is if you essentially look at all workers, you don't make any kinds of distinctions about how long people are on the job. You do come up with this figure that's getting close to 4 million people. To me, that seems to be a pretty significant number. And again, as I guess the point is that these are not people who were fired because someone thought they were doing a bad job. It was because of things like plant closures and reduction in force, that really led to the loss of these particular jobs for these people.
That's right. The federal government has historically defined displaced workers as those who have two or more than 2 years' tenure on the job. As a sociologist, I think that's an important distinction, but still, when people lose good jobs, the 2 years' tenure seems irrelevant at the household level. When you look at those who have reported that they've lost jobs, the numbers approach 4 million and may well go over that this year, given the circumstances.
And just to make the other point that I know that you have in some of the things that you've written, that it seems that this particular aspect, I'm sure that economists and other people have looked at the impact on the larger economy of a plant closure or of this kind of loss of particularly of manufacturing jobs. But it seems that, for example, people in your field, sociologists and others, have not given very much attention to what this really means for the people on the individual level and perhaps also on the community level, what exactly that means.
Right. I would say, in fact, most researchers focus on the macro level, the national level. And, in fact, we have been a little bit remiss in taking this down to the level where it actually plays out, which is the household. But there are some good case studies out there. I have a good friend who's just published a book on how it affects older workers. And there are, you know, in the case study literature, there are some studies that look at the effects for real people in the real world.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I want to make sure that we spend some time here talking about in some detail was one particular case that you looked at, and you had the opportunity to talk with people who had worked at a Firestone plant in Decatur.
Right.
That was closed, officially closed, and I'm sure it's a day people wouldn't end up remembering, Christmas Eve. Christmas Eve in 2001.
That's right.
And 1,250 people.
About 1,250 lost their jobs, including management.
Yeah, and this was at this point it wasn't exactly a surprise. They knew that this was coming.
Right. Federal legislation requires 6 months' notice for plants with more than 100 workers.
And so then you had the opportunity to talk with some of these people and do sit down and do or at least do surveys with them to get some idea about what their life was like after the closing, and that you managed to do that a couple of times during the first year after the plant closed.
That's right. We sent out blind surveys, anonymous surveys to the displaced workers. And we also had a small focus group of eight people who helped us make sense of the results we were getting from the surveys. We did it initially at the initial closing, 6 months later, and then 1 year after the closure.
And what reason did the company give for closing this plant?
They said they had excess inventories of tires. They had also just built a factory down in South Carolina, and the workers at Firestone and Decatur, you know, would argue that they built a non-union plant in South Carolina to close a union plant in Decatur, Illinois. There were also other issues. This was the same plant that had had the tire issue. Most of the blowouts were manufactured in Decatur. Hmm. So it was actually a real mess. But in the final analysis, 5 years later, Decatur lost its plant, and 1,250 families were sent packing.
And on average, for the people who had been working there, how had they been working there for a long time?
There were two groups. There was one group that had been hired after the strikes. I think the strikes were in 93 or somewhere around there. And then, so they had about 6 or 8 years tenure with the factory. And then there was another group that had been there. They averaged 25, 30 years, some of them. So there were really two groups of workers, those who were replacement workers from the earlier strike period and those who had been there throughout.
Mm-hmm. I have somebody here that who is calling in, and I want to get right to this person. I don't want to make him wait too long. But just as one kind of bottom line here question that I can ask is, for those people who did indeed find employment after having lost this job, if you just look at their wages, you know, what they were making at Firestone and then what they were making at the job that they had afterwards, what kind of spread was there between what they were making before and what they were making after?
Right, that's important. The people who were hired at the date of the closure had lost about 50% of their wages. They went from $20 an hour down to $10 an hour on average. Those who we looked at 6 months later were averaging $13 an hour. So it looks like those who immediately rushed into the market included some people who were afraid to be unemployed and took any job. But it was between maybe a 33% and a 50% reduction in wages on mm-hmm. average.
And that's sort of an understatement, but that's a really significant loss in income.
Oh, it is. It's about $20,000 per household. Uh-huh. It was a big difference.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Robert Hieronymus Wendt. He is Assistant Professor of Sociology at Western Illinois University, and we're talking at least in part about some of the work that he did looking at the effect on workers of the closing of a Firestone plant. This was in Decatur, where they made tires, and the plant closed Christmas Eve 2001. And this is one of, as he explains, a sort of small number of studies that have been done looking at the real effects on individuals. What happens in a case like this, say when a plant closes and all these folks, these some 1,250 people, lose their jobs, and what kind of jobs they get afterwards. And also one of the things we'll talk about is what kind of assistance there is for folks like this to try to help them get other jobs. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in Seneca, so that's where we'll go, line number 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. You know, that's kind of happening right now. In fact, it's going in large numbers. I'm a product of it. Let's just put it to you this way. I took a $30,000 hit from last year to this year.
Right.
And it's a shame because I see this country, the whole country, basically, all the engineering, all the manufacturing jobs, most of them that are left here, are already talking about leaving because of the high cost of labor. Now, I'm not going to blame the unions on this, but I'm kind of blaming ourselves because the cost of living and the way we live our daily lives has gotten so out of whack. And the housing crisis is a good example that it's costing everybody's jobs now. And you know, just the self-gratification of America, is what I call it, is part of the reason. Now, what I'm concerned about is that we're not going to be making anything in this country anymore, and we're going to be solely buying from other countries, which is, if you look at any automobile as a good example, I'd say probably quite a bit, if not you know, two-thirds of it is manufactured in other countries. I mean, as far as parts to the car. It's hard. I'm a product of a layoff a couple of times. I'm actually doing my fallback job, and now my fallback job is I'm finding out I have to – you actually, in this day and age, you have to be – at 52, it's very difficult to find anything out there, but you're finding yourself going back to college, if you can afford it, and multitasking and learning two or three different jobs because one isn't sufficed anymore. And I feel for all the rest of the families. I'm fortunate that my wife still works, but that's short-lived. Because in the field I'm in now, there's nobody out there. The service industry, it's just gone down the hole. I don't know if there's an end in this country anymore. It just seems to me like we're catering to other countries and other groups of people outside of this country and not taking care of ourselves. And I firmly believe it's a high cost of labor. I mean, I don't mind doing a job at a certain amount of money, but what's the difference between, for instance, a Toyota worker who makes a car on a union job and a guy, say, that's non-union? And you hear the commercials on TV all the time, same thing. They want to badmouth all the rest of us that aren't union.
Yeah. Can I ask your name?
We don't ask people for their names. Just we sort of long time ago thought, well, we just be totally anonymous, so we don't even ask people for the names. But go ahead. I'm particularly interested in
you do raise some really really good points. This isn't a union non-union issue. I by the way am 50 and have been displaced twice myself, so I share a lot of concerns with the caller. And he's right to point out this is a really complex issue. We're looking at a country that is losing its ability to produce commodities. We're looking at wages that are falling below those necessary to sustain a family and purchase a home and buy a car. And we're importing goods that eventually we're going to have a hard time buying. So it's a very complicated mess. But your caller is absolutely right. To pit this as union, non-union is problematic. As a sociologist, would argue we should focus on a family wage, a good job that pays a wage that supports a family. And I think, $20 an hour equals about $40,000 a year. That's the median income in America. I think that's a reasonable wage for anyone, a union or non-union.
Let me ask you this, just to pick on something the caller said. I don't know whether you had the opportunity to have this kind of conversation with any of the people we're talking about, but whether any of them voiced any kind of concerns about how they might have priced themselves out of the market. I mean, did they think that somehow they had maybe unreasonable demands for high wages or benefits or whatever had ultimately led the company to say, well, we can do this cheaper if we do it someplace else where it's a non-union shop and maybe we'll just move to some other state?
No, I don't recall any of the workers in their responses saying that they found that their wages were perhaps negotiable or too high. And bear in mind, a lot of these people had been at this job for a long time and were making $20 an hour. You're talking about 50-year-old people making $40,000 a year and with overtime and maybe pushing 55. So there wasn't a sense that they had much room to give. They all had mortgages. They had children in college. They had car payments.
Mm-hmm. For those we talked to ask you about this bottom line question about the reduction in standard of living. That is, for these people who lost jobs, the job that they got to replace the one that they lost, what they'd paid and how much difference there was. And you said that there was could be anything between about a 30% loss of income to a 50% loss of income when you look at the jobs that people got. Part of this might have had to do with the fact that there were some people right at the beginning where they knew they were going to lose their jobs, were concerned about having a job, and so they left and took what they could, and that maybe those people did not do as well as some others. But having said that, if you ask this question, what for the individual worker, what really makes the difference between a big loss in income and a smaller one, the difference between a job that paid something close to what they were making before and really nothing close to what they were making before. What makes the difference?
I think that, too, is complex. I think part of it is whether or not they are so concerned that they must work. From a conservative standpoint, there are people such as my father who felt unemployment was unacceptable and he would not be unemployed. So when he lost his job when we stopped making televisions in the 1980s, he immediately took a job at a bowling alley making minimum wage. So that fear that I'm not going to be able to provide for my family scares a lot of people, and rightly so. They should be concerned. But you have to shop carefully for new jobs. In fact, our study suggests that if people shouldn't jump right back into work because it, in Firestone, for example, it was 2 months after the closure that the federal government declared this closure being related to foreign competition, and as a result opened up Trade Adjustment Act benefits. So those who had jumped right into the workforce sacrificed the ability to go to community college and learn new trades or skills and sacrificed their eligibility for a lot of additional unemployment support. And so rushing into the labor market makes sense from a masculine perspective, but it can be problematic.
Well, that goes to the question, though, could they, and I expect that a number of these cases, we did have two worker families, so maybe one person still had a job, but we had people who had bills to pay and they had kids that they had to take care of. Would they have reasonably been able to go, you know, say we had a two-earner family, would they reasonably, would they have been able to go, say, 2 months?
Right.
With only what that one person was bringing in.
Right. We had some people who had, for example, 50 years old, had paid off their mortgage or were close to paying it off and could renegotiate their loans. In those cases, these people were stable. And you know, they also lost their jobs, but some of them were able to retire and most of them were able to make do, even though for many it was painful. On the other hand, you have younger workers who are at the beginning of their mortgage, at the front end of their debt load, so to speak. And for these workers, making do is really difficult when you drop from, you know, $20 an hour to minimum wage or $10 an hour. You're going to have to sacrifice. We had workers selling cars, selling boats. We had 10% of our workers declare bankruptcy. We had 10% of the, or 14% of the displaced workers, I believe, said that they had attempted to sell their home. So for, you know, a small but substantial group, the plant closing was devastating. You know, you have to sell your home. You have to move to a new neighborhood. You have to uproot your children. On the other hand, for some of the older workers, they were able to weather the storm a good bit better. But again, not all of the older workers.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with someone else in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah.
Just briefly as I can, a bit of a narrative. I'm one of those persons who left a large local firm, SuperValu, in the early 90s, went to college. I have a Bachelor of Arts from the University of Illinois, and of necessity, I'm back working for the same corporation, SuperValu, except doing exactly what I used to do in the 90s, except now I get paid about half of what I did back then and don't have anywhere near the benefits and so forth. And one of the things that changed during that period was that SuperValu went from being a largely union shop to a non, it's found various ways of breaking its unions, and as a result, as this is typical around the country, I think, about the time of the Reagan Revolution, say in the early 80s, the chairman and CEO of SuperValu made roughly 40 times annual, or his annual compensation was roughly 40 times of what I made in that year. Last year, the chairman and CEO of SuperValu made $18.5 million, which is something like 450 times what I'm now earning. And my point is, I strongly disagree with you about the union question. I think there has to be a resurgence of organized labor in this country or something like that, because I don't know of any other mechanism to force capital to do anything except force labor into a race to the bottom. if you don't like, if they don't like the wages that are being paid in this state, well, we'll just move our operation to another state where the wages are less, and so on and so forth. I don't think we're going to see any kind of rise in median income in this country until we get something that looks an awful lot like that, and functions like that, that so forth. And, but the, one of the things I really wanted to ask you about is the fact that it just astonishes me that the average American worker, Joe and Betty Sixpack, so on and so forth, just seem to take it as their due that labor has its right to, or capital has its right to do what it wants to with them and treat them as badly as it wants, and you know, we'll just throw you these slops, and if you don't like it, we'll throw them to somebody else in some other country or some other state, and take it or leave it. If you would comment on that, please. Thank you.
Well, thank you. You raised some good points, and your point about union, non-union is well taken. I've worked both sides of that issue. And you're, I think, right to point out that there is a rugged individualism, as people have said in America, that we're responsible for our own destiny. And I agree with you, that's not well served. When we fight for our own jobs, and those jobs don't pay enough to provide our families, and we're told we need to make concessions, it serves no one's interest, including the nation. One of the recommendations, in fact, that came out of our study was to, you know, to seriously rethink how we address displacement, seriously address, for example, when plants abandon communities, are there social obligations that they should be held to? If a local community has granted tax incentives to a corporation to create jobs in that local community, and from the corporate side that means savings, or profits, then should that company be obligated, for example, to reinvest those savings into enhancing worker productivity so that their workers are allowed to continually upgrade their skills? There are really two sides of this argument. One of them is from the corporate side is there are problems with worker productivity, and yet everyone that I've talked to and the people I follow suggest that American worker productivity is not the issue. It's the it's access to jobs, and we're shedding these manufacturing jobs. In 1950, over a third of Americans produced commodities. Today, about 11% of Americans produce commodities. I would argue we need to recreate those jobs. We need to rethink the economy. I'm even in favor of a modified version of protectionism for American jobs. Interestingly, President Obama announced today on NPR that he was going to rethink NAFTA when it comes up for renewal. I think that's where we start. You know, we don't protect commodities, but we do need to protect jobs and wages. And so, you know, if we can avoid the political banter about protectionism and start thinking seriously about making sure Americans have enough money to consume the commodities that are in front of us, I think that's where we start.
We're at our midpoint here. I have some other callers we'll get to in a moment, but I would like to introduce again the guest for anyone who has tuned in the last 10 or 15 minutes. Robert Hieronymus-Wendt is Assistant Professor of Sociology at Western Illinois University, and we're talking about worker displacement. It's estimated by the Department of Labor that between 3 and 4 million people are displaced every year from their jobs, meaning that they lose their jobs because plants close or they reduce workforce, not because they were doing a bad job. He makes the point in some of his writing that there haven't really been very many case studies of individuals, what this means for individuals in their lives and perhaps also for the community, of this kind of job loss. And one of the things that he had the opportunity to do was talk with or do surveys of workers who worked at a Firestone plant in Decatur, where they made tires, that closed in December of 2001. Something like 1,250 people lost their jobs. And he was able to survey them at several points during the year after the closure to find out what the consequences were for them in their standard of living and what kind of jobs they managed to get after they lost their jobs at Firestone, and what it meant for them, both economically and emotionally and physically. That's what we're talking about here. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let me just, before we go back to calls, I want to ask you about talk about one other thing, and that is for these folks who lost their jobs, the state had essentially two kinds of approaches to try to help them. There was unemployment insurance, and then there was an office that was charged with trying to provide training and retraining to help people get other jobs. And when people talked about their experiences and what they thought these two kind of offices had for them, how they helped them, what did people say?
Well, you're right. There were basically two services that were in the same house or actually a couple blocks down from each other. One was the unemployment services, which was concerned with helping people find jobs. In fact, our grant was funded by the governor's office. We received a couple thousand dollars to study the online search engine, so to speak, and its effectiveness, and that turned out to be very ineffective. Or only two of the people that we interviewed said that they had found a job by going into the unemployment office and using the online search. On the other hand, they were not opposed to doing that. I don't want to suggest that these workers resisted that. But they found things like word of mouth and knowing the right people. Those were the search techniques that paid off for most of these workers, bumping into jobs. On the other hand, after this was declared a trade adjustment issue, workers became eligible for going to Workforce Investment Solutions. This organization is also state-funded and is designed to help workers develop the skills necessary for job openings in the local community. And they got pretty good success rates, actually. The workers found this to be a good approach, right? Retooling, learning new skills for the new economy. Many of these workers, for example, were pursuing things like anything from nursing to what have you. And they found that working through the local community college was a successful strategy. There was a third option, that was working with private sector job training services, and those were deemed largely ineffective. And in fact, some of the workers were quite angry about those services.
I get the impression that some people felt that some of the services that were available were geared towards, it was almost as if they were trying to help somebody who had never had a job.
Right.
It was as if they were assuming that somehow this person had no idea how to apply for a job.
Right. And some of the workers initially were put off by that. You know, these were people who had good jobs in the good community. They were good blue-collar jobs paying family wages. And so these people knew how to work. They had the human capital, so to speak, to get up and go to work and punch a clock and do a good job. So they were initially put off by some of these workers were initially put off by the fact that they were treated as a number, simply told to go through the hoops. They found that the explanations given didn't make sense. For example, one worker, I have a quote in front of me, it says, basically everything is put on you to do. I'm used to doing everything on my own anyway, but there's not actually any guidance involved. And so they wanted more help and more hands-on and more empathy. That came out loud and clear. They wanted more compassion, at least from the unemployment office.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll take some other calls here. We'll go next to Belgium, line 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I'm located over here on the very eastern edge of Illinois, and I'm sure if you know about Decatur, you know about Danville.
I do.
And Danville started in this spiral in 1975, 6, 7, 8, right through there, and I lived through it. Between 75 and 90, I went through six different layoffs, and horrible time. Every time I walked away with tears in my eyes saying it's my fault. It's not your fault. It really isn't. The employee is not to blame in this situation. So at that point, I decided I'd start my own business. I've run a little cabinet shop here for a long, long time. Mr. Inge knows me. And now this time, I'm frightened that I'm not even going to be able to survive in that because this economy is so bad, so horrible, that any work I try to get, I go to corporations, they don't have work. I go to individuals, they don't have money to buy. It's very frightening this time. It's much more frightening than just being laid off from a job. We're talking about an economy that is failing rapidly.
You're right. And first of all, I think the workers at Firestone would say they feel for you. They went through many layoffs themselves.
And that buffered them a little bit. When this finally happened, many of them had dealt with temporary layoffs, so they knew how to struggle and how to survive. But you're right, this is in many ways broader. It's a much bigger problem. When people don't have money to spend, it hurts the secondary sector, the service sector, just as well or just as strongly as it affects those losing their jobs.
And it affects so many areas. I mean, even hospitals are having problems. Every place is having. You can't find any section of the work area that's not having problems now.
That's right. That's right.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
I
think that the caller makes a very important point, and you see it in some of the reporting that's been done all over the country, and that is people are losing their jobs, and as we've made this point, it's not their fault that they're losing the job. They weren't fired because they were doing a bad job. They were fired because a company was trying to reduce its cost or increase its profits or both. They were being fired because we simply have a downturn in the economy and the market's just not there for the product. I mean, they're cutting back production. There are all kinds of things, all kinds of reasons. But that people have... It's difficult for people not to feel somehow that it is their fault.
Right. But, you know, the depth of this recession and the breadth of it, because that's what we're talking about now, is amazing. And it suggests there are going to be no quick fixes. We have to sit down and seriously think through how we want to resolve this economy. One thing I would suggest is the federal government and the state governments need to look at enhancing access to education. Right now, they say, for example, if you've been displaced, you're allowed to take a position at a community college where you can learn a trade or a skill. You're given 2 years to learn it. But this is going to drag on beyond 2 years. Hopefully, it will rebound shortly, but we're at a very deep hole.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, one of the things I'm suggesting to anyone who would listen is that what's wrong with allowing some of these workers access to the four-year education program? For example, many of these people could be wonderful mechanical engineers, industrial engineers, civil engineers. Many of these people would be incredible teachers. They could, you know, if allowed a four-year degree, they could be wonderful social studies teachers, for example. Many of them might fit into mathematics and science, given that they've been doing math and science for 30 years. So right now, I think we need to rethink unemployment policy, too. We don't simply need to extend benefits. We need to rethink benefits as well. This is going to, you know, require us to rethink what we want from our economy.
Let's take another call. Champagne, line two, there next. Hello.
Good morning. I'm taking a slightly different perspective that's based upon my own experience that was the product of the way in which my parents raised me and my siblings, and they emphasized to us that making assumptions about what will happen or continue to happen is a very foolish way of approaching life. And they indicated to us that we always need to be prepared for the unexpected. And as a result, all of us have in our careers been prepared for changes, and not only prepared for changes, but prepared to look for alternatives that would support us in times of difficulty. I think that there's too much of a passive attitude that relates to a sort of an entitlement feeling that individuals have a right to a job, and that attitude has to be, I think, fundamentally changed, and it will take much agony for it to change, and I don't believe it will occur in this generation. Thank you.
I think we actually agree in some context. For example, I think the idea of workers taking care of their needs by retooling and constantly preparing for the inevitable makes sense, because most workers change jobs four or five times. I think that's consistent with my suggestion that we start allowing a corporation or allowing workers to enhance their worker productivity while they're on the job so that they're learning additional skills that may pay out down the road. I don't take much exception with what you've said.
But that do you think that it is the case that at least in the past that there were too many people who had this mindset that said, well, I have this job and that's going to be my job for the rest of my life. I'm going to do this and then I'm going to retire and enjoy the benefits of a pension or savings or, you know, whatever I managed to put aside all that time.
Well, I would guess your caller would recognize that's probably the one place where I do disagree. I come at it from a different perspective. Hmm. I'm from the South, where we're steeped in history and government and tradition and all that stuff. And so I believe that life, liberty, and the pursuit of property are inalienable human rights. We call it the pursuit of happiness because the founders of our Constitution, were landed aristocracy, so they didn't want to guarantee the right to pursue property. So they called it happiness. But more importantly, I think all Americans are entitled to jobs, and all jobs should pay sufficient wages. And so your caller would know, I'm sure, that I'm on the on the other side of the fence, at least with this aspect of his comments. But again, much of what he says is correct. His parents raised him well. We need to be prepared to take new jobs. When I lost my job, the first thing I did was go to my church and cry to my preacher, and then I went home and cried some more, and the next morning I started applying for new work. I was fortunate in the sense that in academia you're giving 9 months' notice as opposed to 6 months' notice. But he's right in many, many regards. We do need to realize that whether or not we're entitled by the Constitution, that's not necessarily how the economy plays out.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Robert Hieronymus Wendt, is Assistant Professor of Sociology at Western Illinois University. We're talking about worker displacement, something that he's done some study of, particularly of what happened to people in Decatur who worked at a Firestone plant there that closed in December of 2001. And he did surveys talking with people, trying to gather information about how their lives changed, what happened with their standard of living, how they felt about what happened, what it meant for the community during the first year after that closure. Questions welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Next, we'll talk with someone in Mahomet, line one. Hello? Is the caller there, line one? Okay, how about we go to line three? This is someone in Chicago. Hello?
Yeah, how you doing?
Yeah.
We're talking about jobs, and the reason you work a job is for money. And I think the question the American people have to ask themselves is, why does their government choose to borrow money from a private bank, the Federal Reserve, at interest, when the government can create all the money it wants debt-free? I think we have to get away from having a debt-based monetary system that promotes scarcity. That's the problem out there, is the scarcity. You talk about lack of money. Well, our debt-based monetary system promotes scarcity.
Well,
and the government spending money into circulation, like the Constitution was originally, set up to do. We issue all money in circulation comes from loans. You have to borrow it into circulation.
Well, I don't know if that's a little outside of what we're talking about. Our guest is not an economist, but I don't know if that's something that you want to say something about.
Printing money is simply devaluing the dollars that currently exist, so that can be problematic. You do create recessionary pressures that way, too. On the other hand, borrowing at interest, it really depends from my perspective, and I'm not an expert with monetary policies, but it would seem to me that it's dependent on what that interest rate is. If that interest rate is designed to make sure that the money returned keeps the lenders, on par with the economy, that makes sense to me. If, on the other hand, you're talking about 10 to 20% interest rate on that money, that to me is just unimaginable.
All right. Well, let's go to another caller here. This is Urbana, line two. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Uh-huh.
Good morning.
The president has been talking a lot about this renewable energy economy. And I understand there's something like $50 billion in the new stimulus bill for that. I was wondering, do you Did you have an opinion? Did you see that as a program that might provide a way out for potentially good jobs?
Well, it's
in the future.
It's interesting you say that, because over here in Western Illinois, we're maybe a month ahead of the schedule on that. I think by luck, perhaps. But for example, I live outside of Macomb on a farm, and in the up by my, I don't farm. I'm just I read books. I don't farm. But up where we are, they're actually building a wind farm now, and they had started planning that several months ago. Over in Keokuk, Iowa, they're also building they have on hold, but they intend to build a factory for making wind turbines. I do see that as an important option. That is a part of our new economy. It also is a way to cut down on consumption of fossil fuels. I think that's a good example of ways to rethink our economy and so as to create jobs. We need to manufacture stuff, and we need to pay decent wages in America. Otherwise, if we don't pay decent wages, we can't consume, and if we don't create jobs, we don't really have wages. So I think this is a good, at least short term, if not, a decade or a couple decades worth of solid investment.
Okay, great. Well, they're talking about putting wind farms here in Champaign County, too.
Good.
So it seems to be catching on. Well, anyway, thank you very much.
All right,
thank you.
We'll go over to another caller here. This is someone listening in Paris, Illinois, line 4. Hello.
Yes, I think you're right about extending educational benefits to people to get an opportunity to retool their minds to put new jobs in the new market. What really astounds me is that the medical field expenses have gone up tremendously over the last 15 years, but educational expenses have doubled that compared to medical expenses, and I think we need to make education affordable for lots of people, and especially if we could make education and slant it into creative ways of entrepreneurship so that people can come up with new ideas and new industries, because this country is no longer a blue-collar manufacturing country. It's going to have to come up with new concepts to survive in the global market.
Right.
In addition, a lot of times this stuff takes a lot of time, and we have to adjust for maybe longer periods of unemployment. Well, what about the idea of service for serving and maybe people volunteering for nursing homes or for educational institutions to help foster some of these areas that need extra help, rather than government subsidies to help them out, help to have people extend their benefits with make some service in some of these institutions where they desperately need more help. I'd like to hear your ideas.
First of all, with the last comment, I'm a strong advocate of community-based service. I'm an advocate of it in higher ed as well, under the movement called service learning. I think that's real important. Secondly, I agree with you. The problem I have with the current policy is that it says we will allow you to attend college for up to 2 years to learn a skill if that skill is in demand in your local labor market. And while that in some ways is good, it's also in many ways irrational. If the local labor market is declining, then why would you be retooling for jobs that are on the down, the downslide? I, as I said earlier, I think we need to realize, as you suggest, this is going to be a long-term process. We're going to create a new economy, and in doing so, we have to create new workers who have the skills that will match that new economy. If we try to train people to take the existing jobs, that seems irrational to me.
Well, I think you're right, except there are pockets of places that maybe they don't have manufacturing jobs.
Right.
To retool them for manufacturing jobs, but retool them for areas that need help.
Right.
And will continue to need help in the future, like medical care.
In particular, nursing. I had a
respondent from Firestone who pursued this route. And when he was doing it, I kept thinking, well, why can't he come here to Millikan and get a four-year degree? Why is that ruled out? If he's really good in his training at Decatur Memorial and at Richland Community College, why not allow him the option of going an additional 2 years to Millikan for a BSN? There's a good study out by Jacobson, LaLonde, and Sullivan, who are big-time economists, and they show that education has the long-term payoff for the workers, and equally important, their data suggests it also has long-term payoff for the state. So investing in workers' human capital makes sense at the worker level and the state level.
Absolutely. Well, I like your approach, and hopefully we can get more of these programs to create creative entrepreneurial spirits and people to fill in where we really need it in our economy. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
We'll go on here, get at least one more caller. The next person is in Urbana in line three. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I have 2 points really fast. One is that businesses are trying to cut money too, and so they tend to hire people as part-time employees rather than full-time employees so that they don't have to give them benefits. And that means that people then have to find more than one job and then pay their own benefits. And so that actually makes it very tough to, first of all, feel like you're a valued employee, and second of all, to actually live a normal life or what people would consider, you know, having a family time and things like that and weekends off, and that just doesn't happen as much as it. The second thing I wanted to point out is that I'm in my mid-40s, and my generation is said to change careers like at least 2 or 3 times during their lifetimes. You know, our parents kind of assumed that they would have a lifetime career, but my generation has assumed that they would always be changing careers. And now I have changed my career several times, but out of choice. And each time I have noticed that it is harder and harder to actually find a full-time employment where they would pay my benefits, you know, and I'm now working on a PhD, and so I'm not educated. I'm very well educated, and then, but yet it's still very hard to find someone who actually pay benefits. And I, you know, I own my own business, and like right now, my tactic right now is to have 3 different jobs, and so that if the economy is bad for my business, then I'm paid by the government to do some stuff, and then I also have a career that I'm working on too. So, you know, diversifying, and that's not. I don't think that that's a normal thing that we should have to be doing in order to be able to have benefits like insurance and things like that. And I'll hang up.
Well, you speak for many people when you say having to take 2 and 3 jobs and still lacking the benefits, and not because you're a woman, but you are speaking of a gendered issue. Women are overwhelmingly hurt by the part-time economy when it comes to things such as providing health care. It speaks to the enormous complexity of this issue, right? The healthcare issue. If we're not going to provide healthcare through employers, how do we guarantee the entitlement to life that is promised in our Constitution? You have the entitlement to life only if you can pay, or do we have the entitlement to life because that's a human, inalienable right? Secondly, with regard to your generation, the only the only thing I would say different, I suppose, is, and I don't think it's necessarily different, but I would emphasize the concept of continually retooling throughout a career. I'm not simply stopping and having to retool at that point, but the idea that corporations, if they're taking tax breaks, would fund, would help their workers take coursework and continually upgrade their skills and talents while they're employees as a return on their tax breaks. That's how I would approach that issue.
We'll try real quick to get one more caller.
Okay.
In,
I'll keep it short.
Okay. In calling from Fisher, line 2. Hello.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I'm very curious about the status of family disintegration with regard to job loss. that undoubtedly has an effect.
Right. Firestone was unique because many of these workers had been through multiple layoffs and many of these workers were older. There wasn't a lot of disruption in the context of divorce and separation. There was a little, but not enough to make it seem abnormal.
Uh-huh.
But that's because these were older workers.
Yeah.
I do think that a major disruption like this on a younger family can be very devastating and can lead to separation and divorce, but I don't know that literature well.
Okay.
On the other hand, there were many, many people who were physically harmed. My favorite sad story is one parent wrote in and said, my son joined the Army today. He's a high school senior, and he signed up for the Army because while he had intended to go to college, now he thinks we won't be able to pay for it. And so there's a lot of these effects that ripple throughout households that are just ignored by current policy. The policy currently says, let's get these people back to work quick, regardless of anything. And I think that approach simply misses the broader picture. We have disrupted families when we disrupt work and when we abandon communities. We disrupt communities. And that's where we need to focus on resolving these issues.
Well, there we will have to stop because for this hour we've come to the end of the time. Our guest with us today.
Thank you, and especially to your callers.